Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, the place to connect your intellect. You can find more info online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Dave McClure, chief pirate and founding partner of 500 Startups, a Silicon Valley venture capital fund and incubator. Tonight, we are joined by Eric Ries. Eric is the creator of the Lean Startup Methodology and author of the popular entrepreneurship blog Startup Lessons Learned. In 2007, Business Week named Ries one of the best young entrepreneurs of tech, and he has worked as a consultant to a number of startups, companies, and venture capital firms, and currently serves on the advisory board of a number of technology startups. He is here today to discuss what he believes is necessary for a successful startup. So let's get started. Eric, I think for many of the folks here in the room, they may know a little bit about the Lean Startup, but for folks at home listening, we'd like to maybe just describe, where did the term Lean Startup come from, and how did you come to be aware of it?
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thanks everybody for being here. This is very exciting. Many times have I listened to Commonwealth Club programs on my commute, so really an honor to be here. We call it Lean Startup by analogy to something called Lean Manufacturing, which over the last few decades has really changed the way physical products are manufactured. Lean manufacturing began in Japan with the Toyota Production System, and its key ideas were that if we focused on cycle time, on really understanding what the customer wants, and most importantly, figure out which of our activities are value-creating and which ones are wasteful, then we can be more efficient in the way that we build things. But startups have a somewhat different problem, which is not that we're not building things efficiently, but that we're building the wrong things. And so if we're building something that nobody wants, why should we be proud of having done it on time and on budget? That was what happened to most of the startups that I've built. And, you know, I have to admit it, most of my startups have failed, so everyone needs to know that. It's a disclaimer right up front. But that's the truth of all entrepreneurs. Wherever there's success, there's been failure before it. And so after my last company called InView was successful, I started to write a little bit about my experiences on this blog, and people started to ask me all kinds of questions about why the crazy things we had done at InView worked, because they went against the grain of what people expected for startups, against the common advice even here in Silicon Valley. And when I was searching for a way of explaining it, I found ideas from lean manufacturing, ideas in lean thinking, really helpful, but they required some tweaks, especially around this question of what really creates value and what's waste. And to make a long story short, my belief is that what creates value for startups is learning if we're on the path to a sustainable business. And once we make that shift in perspective from making stuff to learning which stuff to make, then a lot of the traditional lean tools are actually really useful. So that has kind of laid the foundation for what we now call Lean Startup. And I don't know, the term seemed like a good idea at the time. First time I wrote about this thing called Lean Startup, we were in the middle of a financial crisis, so that was good timing. I wish I could say I had the foresight to know that when people were cutting back, when startups were being encouraged to save money, calling it Lean Startup would be really a useful thing to do. But it caused this really big misconception, because a lot of entrepreneurs would call me up and they're like, I heard you're the Lean Startup expert. I need to save money. You know, can you help me get cheaper office chairs? I was like, oh. I was like, no, hold on. I want to tell you the difference between value-creating activities and which ones are wasteful. And a lot of entrepreneurs are like, wait, what? I didn't sign up for that. I just wanted to save money. But actually, the way you make startups more capital efficient is by helping them realize which elements of their plan make sense and which ones don't, so that they can pivot before it's too late. That really is the root of why Lean Startup works.
So you just mentioned a term that I think is often heard in the Valley these days called the pivot. But again, maybe there's a little bit of background that we want to talk about for the audience listening. Where did the term pivot come from, and what kind of analogies does that have to maybe either basketball or anything else?
Yeah, I didn't really understand what the consequences would be of writing a post about 2 years ago called Pivot, Don't Jump to a New Vision. And since that time, pivot has become probably the most overused buzzword in Silicon Valley. We do this thing in Silicon Valley where we take a concept from obscurity, never heard of it, don't care about it, to it's overhyped and we're sick and tired of hearing about it without having to pass through the intervening stage of learning what it is. And so there's certain...
We jumped the shark pretty fast.
We're really, the hype cycle here is unbelievably fast. And so there were some Silicon Valley-based news places that banned the word pivot from their coverage before ever, as far as I know, having used it correctly. So that has been a challenge. But it's such an important concept, you can't understand entrepreneurship without it. So I don't really make any apologies for the fact that it's become a bit of jargon. We use the analogy to basketball because when entrepreneurs succeed, the great entrepreneurs have this very funny habit. When they run into difficulty, they don't just give up and go home, but neither do they persevere the plane straight into the ground. So we all know those famous stories, what we see in the movies, of, you know, right when you're down to your last dollar, right when things seem bleakest, right when people were calling you the most crazy is when, you know, customers finally flock to you and everything works out great. And those of us who have been entrepreneurs know the truth, which is that in real life, unlike in the movies, when you're down to your last dollar, then you generally go to $0 immediately afterwards, go out of business. It's not like it is in the movies. So we're teaching entrepreneurs that perseverance will solve all your problems, when in fact, perseverance is just another word for stubbornness, and stubbornness causes startups to fail.
So it's not darkest before the dawn, it's darkest before you get buried 6 feet under.
That's absolutely right, probabilistically speaking. Now, we have a lot of entrepreneurs with us today, so I understand your idea isn't going to fail, I'm sure. I want to be good, but look to your left, look to your right.
Exactly.
Their idea probably is crazy. So if your idea is crazy, what do you do? I mean, you can't just give up because, you know, you can't just ask customers what they want. Customers don't know. The cynics are right most of the time. Most ideas are terrible. But the cynics were wrong about the really important breakthrough ideas. So what do? So we come up with this idea of a pivot, which is keeping one foot anchored in what's working so far while changing one other thing about a company's strategy at a time. And I want to be really clear. A pivot is a change in strategy without a change in vision. So we sometimes use the word pivot just as an analogy to, you know, just as a synonym for change. We're just changing the product. That's a pivot, pivoting to a new product. That really doesn't make sense. You can't pivot the vision either, because if you get into entrepreneurship just to make money, I mean, that's really a bad plan. You'd be much better off in investment banking. That's a much more likely way to make money. Entrepreneurship, the odds are really stacked against you. So the only reason to get into it is you really believe you can change the world for the better and you can create a lot of value for customers. You can create an institution of lasting value. So figuring out the path to get there is what strategy, all the stuff about startup strategy, all the stuff we're going to talk about hypothesis testing and minimum viable product, all these things are about figuring out the best path to get to the destination. Pivoting your vision would be like asking your GPS where you want to go. It doesn't make sense. You use your GPS to figure out the best route, and if you hit a detour, you don't just be like, oh, hit a detour, I'm going home, I give up. It's like, no, you figure out a new way to get where you want to go.
So I think maybe, you know, one thing I'm interested in always, like, how did you get started with, you know, figuring out why Lean Startup is relevant for the software industry, or, you know, why you've taken on the mission of writing a book and trying to change, you know, really how software is created today and possibly even how just generally products are created. I think you talked a little bit about maybe a previous failed startup and then the things that worked for you at ImView. What do you think the problems are in current day software development or product development that the Lean Startup can methodology can help address?
Mm-hmm. I really believe the root cause of our problems in product development today is our belief in planning and forecasting as a management tool. In the 20th century, if you look at the really important general management ideas from the 20th century, they all have at their root planning and forecasting. And it makes a lot of sense. Those ideas really worked well. Everyone knows that a general manager who beats plan, or who does things better than expected, should be promoted. And anyone who's, you know, misses plan, you see this in the public markets today. If you miss plan, you're punished. And the base assumption there is that we have the ability to make forecasts of things that will come true. And when I first learned about that idea in general management, I almost fell out of my chair. I was like, wait, you're telling me there was a time in the past when people made forecasts of things and then they happened? I've never heard of that. As an entrepreneur, it's never happened to me ever. I thought forecasting.
As a software engineer, that is a foreign concept.
As a software engineer, never heard of it. I thought plans and forecasts were things we did as a kind of a kabuki ritual for investors so that they would like us. It was kind of a way of proving that we were really serious about it. We're willing to, you know, it's like we could give blood or we could make a plan. It's just a way of incurring pain to show that you really meant it. I didn't understand. that there was a time when things were stable enough that you could make plans. And in fact, as I have learned, in many current companies, parts of their business are still sufficiently stable that planning and forecasting is how management tools work. Now, who feels like the world is getting more and more stable every day? Yeah. That's the problem. What's happening is more and more of our work is being moved outside the domain of general management and into what I call entrepreneurial management, the management discipline that deals with situations of high uncertainty, like building a brand new product.
Right. Which is the domain of startups. And so if this like world of planning and forecasting and optimizing for maybe 2 to 5% increases was sane when we were building cars and on production lines with relatively known solutions to a known problem.
Yeah.
What I think I hear you saying is that basically the business of entrepreneurship, and particularly software entrepreneurship, is really about unknown problems and even unknown solutions to unknown problems, right? And so I think, you know, you mentioned before cycle time, shortening cycle time, I think, getting customer feedback, and then understanding what creates value for customers. Can you explain to us maybe like how do those things get improved by taking a lean startup approach, or what parts of that understanding helps improve product development and software development?
We're trying to take a scientific approach to new product development. And because we think of new product development at startups as creative and complicated and, you know, right now a very sexy, you know, hot topic, sometimes it feels like making it scientific is like, oh, that's trying to reduce it to a formula. That's not exciting and cool. But actually, I believe science is one of humanity's most creative pursuits. So I think it is a very positive thing to make new product development more scientific. In order to do that, we have to treat everything a startup does as an experiment. So the question is not can it be built, because we are lucky enough to live in a time where we can build anything we can imagine, which is pretty exciting, except that it's also a little bit daunting. It means that our future GDP growth depends on the quality and caliber of our collective imaginations, which is a kind of an odd place to be from a historical standpoint. The question of our time is not can it be built, but should it be built? Is this a good use of resources, or should we have the people who are currently working on this go do anything else? And in a lot of cases, the answer is anything else would be better than building a product that nobody wants. So we want to reconceive our product development efforts as experiments. And when we do that, it unlocks a new way of going faster. Those of us who are engineers have been trained in how do you take a specification? You know, some business person hands you a document that says, we're going to build a product that works just like this. And an engineer's job is to say, oh, here's how we can build that specification with minimum effort. You know, I got a great idea for new technology that'll help us achieve the spec. But when we get scientific, we can ask a new question, which is, how do we run that experiment to get that data at minimum cost? And that really, the core idea here is what we call the minimum viable product. Not the most complicated, exciting version of the product we can imagine, but the smallest, simplest one that can help us start the process of learning whether we're on the right track. So at a company called InView, we started out with a really brilliant strategy, if I do say so myself. And when we diagrammed it at the whiteboard, it seemed absolutely brilliant. It was going to help our product, you know, spread virally through the internet, take over everything. It was going to be great. And to make a long story short, the strategy was brilliant in every respect except one, and which is that it was completely wrong. But it looked really good. It made a lot of sense. It's just that customers refused to behave in the way that the strategy said that they would. So, you know, and unfortunately, we couldn't, you know, explain the strategy to them, every customer. You know, we like send them a copy of our business plan. Like, here's how you're supposed to behave. They wouldn't do it. And we spent about 6 months, which we thought was a very aggressive timeline, building what we thought was the minimum viable product. We put it out on the internet, and I was an engineer. I was a chief technology officer at this company, and I was really worried that the product was low quality, it was buggy, it might crash people's computers. I was like, oh gosh, this is going to ruin my reputation if we ship this thing. But when we finally did ship it, it didn't ruin my reputation because nobody would even download it. So at first I was relieved. I was like, well, phew, at least nobody found out how bad it was. Until I was like, wait a minute, why did I just spend the last 6 months of my life building a product that nobody would download? And the question that I started to ask was, if the problem was that the fundamental value proposition we were offering was so far off that customers wouldn't even try it to find out how bad it was, why did it take 6 months? Would we have gotten the same learning if we had just created a single web page in an hour that had a screenshot of the product we proposed to build and a big download button? Would we even have had to create page 2 where we apologize that the product doesn't exist? No. What did I say? They wouldn't download it. That literally means they mechanically would not click that button, and so they never found out that they didn't care. And that, for me as an engineer, that was very, very disturbing. Because what did it say on my business card? It said, Chief Technology Officer. It did not say chief little learning landing page experiment officer. And so it was like, how is it possible that my work, my blood, sweat, and tears the last 6 months could have the same value as this really simple experiment that we could have run in an hour? It was very unsettling. And that is at the heart of what this is about. Because once we start to ask that question, how can we get the learning that we need about how to build a sustainable business? It unlocks dramatically faster ways to get that learning, some of which are as simple as an hour. That's why the Lean Startup is more capital efficient.
And I think, you know, you're also basically breaking down the walls of some ivory towers that have been in, you know, Silicon Valley or even in, you know, kind of the scientific and academic circles for many years. And, you know, that crystal realization of like, you know, wow, I probably could have done this very simple experiment in about 15 minutes and gotten more useful feedback than spending 3 months coding this program or something. And I, you know, for folks in the software profession where, you know, specifications and waterfall methodology, and I almost think there's like this geek model of insecurity that wants us to make it more perfect, right? I don't want to show anybody this until it's perfect, because I never get a second chance to make a first impression, which I would kind of guess you probably don't believe that cliche.
Well, it's true, but if you have zero customers, it really doesn't matter what the impression is.
Right.
Or if you only have a very small number of customers, the great thing about having a pathetically small number of customers is that you can get to know each and every one of them extremely well. And you can apologize. You can personally apologize to each of them for sending them such a bad product. I have had this experience. Right. It's not that much fun for me, but customers generally love it. Can you imagine the CEO of a company whose product doesn't quite work right calls you up to apologize and promises to make it right? Wouldn't that be exciting?
And the way I think I like to say this is, as a startup, you can actually afford to piss off a lot of small customer groups before you even get to 1% of the market. So,
yeah, if you really believe there's a lot of customers out there, then, yes, the few, you know, who don't like your product, that's okay. And that's really unsettling, because we've all been taught in our schools, in our professional training, you know, always put your best foot forward, always work hard. If you work hard and do good work, you will be rewarded. But in entrepreneurship, that's just not true. If you work hard and do good work, most of the time, nobody cares. And you don't get a gold star. You don't get promoted. There's no such thing as a promotion in entrepreneurship. All you get is to stay alive and keep doing it. That's the reward. And so a lot of us are sitting there in our startups waiting for someone to come give us the gold star. And that leads a lot of entrepreneurs to waste a lot of time doing what I call success theater, which is all the work we do, especially here in places like Silicon Valley, to make people think we're being successful. So talking to the press and sending out all what we call vanity metrics, the biggest numbers we possibly can come up with that have no bearing whether our business is actually being successful.
Millions of unique visitors.
Yeah, it's like if I have, you know, 100 million messages sent on my platform, is that good? Well, it might be 100 million people trying my product once and churning out. Or it could be one guy with a really active web browser. Does it tell you anything about the product? And that wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't for this bug in human psychology that vanity metrics prey upon, which is when the numbers go up, it's always because of the thing I was working on at the time. So when I meet with engineers and I ask them, hey, how do you know you're making progress? They always say the same thing. Well, we did these new features, a new version of our product last month, and this month the numbers are higher, therefore A caused B. But if I go down the hall to their colleagues in marketing, ask them the same question, I know exactly what they're going to say. Well, we did this great new marketing campaign last month, and this month the numbers are higher. That wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't for the fact that when the numbers go down, what happens? Oh, now it's somebody else's fault. So everyone in a traditional company that's run by vanity metrics gets the constant experience of they're always right, their department's always doing good work, and those idiots down the hall are constantly sabotaging it. And it isn't any wonder that our modern companies are dominated by internecine warfare between departments. Everyone gets to live in their own private reality. So we have to break down that paradigm and get away from vanity metrics, and you know that's really what the Lean Startup movement is dedicated to. Just comment on one other thing that you said, which is that we actually, in our labs, are training scientists to do amazing science. And I gave an interview to a newsletter of university technology transfer offices. These are people who's tasked with taking scientific breakthroughs out of university labs and turning them into commercially viable companies. And they're not getting a very good success rate. I mean, it's appalling, actually, what's happening. And the reason, I believe, is that we take these world-class scientists, and as soon as we take them out of the lab, we ask them to do astrology. Right? Think of what I said a second ago. We did this thing, and then the numbers went up the next month. Therefore, A caused B. You can imagine the scientists who tried to get away with that in a paper. It's outrageous. So I meet with engineers all the time, and I say something like, they say, oh, we did X, the numbers went up, that's why. And I say, great, I have an alternate theory. My theory is that Mercury was in retrograde last month. And that causes the numbers to get up. And anyone who's a scientist will be offended. You know, how could I accuse them of being astrology? That makes no sense. That's crazy. But I'm like, well, which of us is crazy? Because I'm just visiting, but you live here. And neither of us knows what's going on. So it's fine for me, but if you care about your company. So we actually have this incredible untapped resource, especially in our university labs, of people trained in the scientific method. If we can get them to apply that training with the same level of rigor when they become business scientists, it's going to unlock an incredible wave of commercialization. It's going to be very exciting.
So I love getting to play talk show hosts. As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's In Forum, the place to connect your intellect. And tonight we're hosting Eric Ries, author of The Lean Startup. I'm Dave McClure, chief pirate at 500 Startups. So I think something that we're also talking about is getting used to imperfection. And something I believe Reid Hoffman was quoted as saying was, ship as soon as you possibly can to the point of being completely embarrassed. And sometimes I hear people then take that to the other end, which is they want to start marketing it as soon as they launch it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think my experience has been you want people to launch early but promote late, because there's still a lot of time where you're collecting information and trying to figure out, do they like this? How can I change it? How can I get to this elusive product market fit? And maybe if you could take a minute to just say, you know, what does that term mean? What are we trying to achieve? You know, product market fit hasn't quite jumped the shark yet, but it is a very commonly used term as well.
Yeah, product market fit is a term that's generally credited to Marc Andreessen, one of the fathers of the internet. And the idea is that when a company is finally successful, when a new market is cracked and you can see, you know, a company like Facebook just taking off campuses everywhere. You know, I remember hearing a story from Mitch Kapor about the Lotus 1-2-3. Remember the Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet? In the first year of that company, they sold $54 million worth of Lotus 1-2-3 and went public the next year. That's in 1983 dollars, right? I mean, that's product market fit. That is saying that this is a product that a large number of people really want, that really solves a problem for them. And the thing about product market fit is, currently, the way we treat it is kind of a you know it when you see it. You know, it's like I always tell entrepreneurs, if you're asking me if you have product market fit, I already know that you don't. Because at Lotus 1-2-3, this is a question they never would have asked. It's a question that Facebook never had to ask. It's a question that once you have the success, once the product is literally flying off the shelves, you don't have to wonder, do we have product market fit? It's really obvious. But as entrepreneurs, that is the most frustrating kind of answer imaginable. Because how do I know if I'm on the brink of success, I'm close to product market fit, or impossibly far away? And one of the things we're trying to do in the Lean Startup movement is take this idea of product market fit and put it on a quantitative basis. We think we can measure how close a team is to product market fit. We have this thing we call it innovation accounting. It's different than innovative accounting, by the way, which can get you arrested. Do be careful.
I think I've done some of that.
Yeah, well, as one of your LPs, I don't like to hear that at all. Innovation accounting is a revolution in the accounting paradigm we use to measure progress under conditions of extreme uncertainty. And I know you guys all came to a talk about entrepreneurship, which is sexy and cool and exciting, and now talking about an accounting revolution, which what could possibly be more boring? I apologize. But if entrepreneurship, if we're any good at entrepreneurship, we actually have to make it a lot more boring. That's one of our explicit goals. It's not like it is in the movies. It's actually grueling, tedious, and as Dave said, really embarrassing. So, you know, we want to make sure people are signing up for entrepreneurship. They know what they're getting into. And so think about your typical investor in a startup. Also, incidentally, your typical CFO who funds an internal startup inside a big company. They both have this problem, which is some entrepreneur comes to you and says, if you give me $1 million and, you know, a bunch of people and a year, I can promise you the sun, the moon, and the stars. We're going to have this new product. It's going to have millions of customers and make you billions of dollars in revenue. It's going to be amazing. And so you say, okay, good. Here's the money. Here's the resources. Let me know how it goes. Fast forward a year later, what do we know for sure? We know for sure that the money got spent.
The money's gone.
The money is always gone. The money always successfully gets spent. We know for sure that the people were kept busy. One of the entrepreneurial superpowers is keeping people busy. We know for sure that certain product milestones were hit, and I would be willing to bet any amount of money. But the other thing we know is that they do not have millions of customers and zillions of dollars in revenue. Probably they have only a handful of customers, maybe even no revenue. Now, what does the entrepreneur say when they come back to the CFO? Every time, I've seen this negotiation so many times, they always say,
we're almost there.
I know we didn't give you what we promised, but if you just give us another year and $5 million, we're on the brink of success. We're almost at product market fit. We learned so much. To the point where I think in most management and VC circles, learning is a four-letter word. Someone who claims to have learned something is about to be fired. Why? Because either they didn't put together a very good plan, in which case they should be fired, or, even worse, they put together a good plan and failed to execute it. So we should, like, double fire them. But in entrepreneurship, we can't make plans with any kind of accuracy. So what are we supposed to do? And I want us to really think about and sympathize with the CFO. By current accounting metrics, things like ROI, profitability, the gross numbers, the vanity metrics, that person literally cannot tell the difference between a team that is, in fact, on the brink of success and a team that has spent the last year goofing off, accomplishing nothing. We're not talking about the difference between an A-plus and an A-minus here. We're saying our current paradigm cannot tell the difference between a team on the brink of success, the next Twitter, the next Google, the next Facebook, and a team that has accomplished absolutely positively nothing. So it's a total breakdown in the way that we're used to measuring progress, and we need an alternative. The alternative, of course, is a little bit complicated, so we can't get into the method in great detail here. But the basic idea, the core idea, is to try to figure out, are the experiments that the team is doing actually affecting customer behavior? And if we can measure that, even if the gross numbers are very small, then we've effectively run a micro-scale experiment that can reveal what's going to happen in the future. So, you know, think about Facebook on the Harvard campus with only a few hundred customers who love the product and are using it obsessively. You know, that is an indicator of product market fit, and, you know, we try to make it more quantitative.
So I think you've brought up a topic that's near and dear to my heart, which is metrics and really, you know, at least talking to customers, if not measuring their behavior. I think one of the things that has been why lean startup movement has had such success and adoption is because we're actually in an era where we can measure customer feedback in real time, to use another overused term. And I guess maybe let's move into talking a little bit about the book and what, you know, you hope to teach people. You know, these ideas around being able to measure customer feedback, be able to make decisions about customer feedback, and trying to learn whether they like it or not. Mm-hmm. How do you, you know, talk about putting those into practice, and where did you even come up with the idea of, like, why I want to write a book? Does that seem like, you know, is that the easiest way to change the world of software? And, you know, that seems very old, dead wood sort of way to kind of change. Why, you have a blog, why do you want to write a book?
The word easy and book should never be in the same sentence ever. I'll take the questions in reverse order. So why write a book? Here in Silicon Valley, you know, we talk about the book business as the putting ink on dead trees business. And so it is a little bit odd it's been very incongruous to come from this fast, customer-driven, feedback-driven, you know, accelerated timeline world and work in the world of traditional publishing. Has not exactly been a meeting of the minds, put it that way. But we're in this really interesting moment for the lean startup movement, which is that for the people who are reading entrepreneurship blogs, this idea is starting to get acceptance. I mean, it has gone from absolutely crazy to something that, you know, at least a certain set of people consider obvious, which is the highest praise an idea can be given. But if you think about what we've been talking about so far, this idea that entrepreneurship is actually a management discipline, then the people who are actually causing the problem are not necessarily the entrepreneurs. We in Silicon Valley celebrate when our entrepreneurs have startups that are, say, acquired by a big company or have the opportunity to go public and work with our, you know, current public markets and investment banks. And yet, if it's really true, if you believe what I said before, that we can't currently tell the difference between success and success theater, then a lot of those startups are actually not successful at all. They're just successful in tricking some big company into buying them. So why is that something we want to celebrate?
Eric, stop. There might be some acquirers in this audience. I want them to buy my companies.
Right, exactly. Look, there is a code of silence around this question, especially in Silicon Valley, because we all want everyone to make money, and we think it's great that these, you know, we call them big, dumb companies in Silicon Valley, buy these startups. And that's great. And yet we all know that most of the time those startups are dead in a year after being acquired. So an asset that was bought for $800 million is now worth $30 million. That is not supposed to happen in general management. But that's actually causing a significant problem in our ecosystem, because guess what? We're now empowering those big, dumb companies and their MBAs and managers to anoint the next generation of leaders in Silicon Valley and other innovation hubs. The people who become our angel investors, our experts, our gurus, are the people who made the most money selling their companies to bigger companies. So why on earth would we want those people to be making these decisions if we honestly believe that they're not educated about entrepreneurship? So I believe that what is needed now is to take these ideas out of just tech hubs like Silicon Valley and really bring them to that broader audience to say, guess what? If you're trying to evaluate progress or understand how to build something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty, guess what? You're an entrepreneur whether you signed up for that or not, and you need to be educated about entrepreneurship. And that, you know, fundamentally, those are people who are listening to programs like this, who are reading books, who look on the bestseller list to see what's selling. I mean, these are not people who are scouring the internet looking for entrepreneurship blogs. And so if we want to reach them with the message, that's really the next step. And for better or for worse, books are still the way that we influence that mass culture, that mass idea.
And so I guess I would say success, theater or not, you've achieved number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. What a failure, Eric. How come you are not number 1? I want to see you in my office tomorrow and really figure this out.
Thank you.
So actually, I've been kind of watching Eric over the last year or two, I believe, as he's been working hard, putting the book together, and really quite an amazing feat to kind of get to number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. And hopefully with the audience listening today, maybe we can get you to number 1 in the next week or so. I want to maybe talk a little bit about, you know, some actual case studies and some examples of companies where you think the lean startup is working, and, you know, maybe not the most likely guesses for what those companies might be. So maybe let's talk about 3 examples, and I think you had mentioned before Groupon, Dropbox, and then a company called Alphabet Energy. Maybe if you could tell us a little bit about their lean stories, and what part of that do you find kind of innovative, and can we learn from those lessons and apply them to our own companies?
Yeah, I mean, Groupon at the moment is living proof that our current accounting methods are not up to the task, because we have 50% experts saying that they are on the brink of bankruptcy and losing money hand over fist, and another group saying they're like one of the most profitable companies ever. It's got to be one or the other.
Right.
I mean, again, we're not talking about the difference between A and A-. We can't tell if it's a complete fraud or the next big thing.
You know, I think Andrew Mason has had enough bad news. Let's try and give him some good news. So what part of the story about Groupon do you think is actually a positive one, and where is it lean?
Yeah, I really love the Groupon story, you know, not what's going on now, but what happened at the beginning, because I was actually just in Chicago, and I got a tour of the Groupon office, and I got to have lunch in the restaurant where the very first Groupon happened. And let me tell you the story for those that don't know. When they started Groupon, it started out not as a social commerce couponing site. It started out as this social activism platform called The Point. Think, you know, Petition Plus Plus. And it was all about helping people petition their local government for grievance and all kind of that kind of stuff. And they spent, you know, about a year and about $1 million on this product and got absolutely nowhere. And they decided, okay, it's time to pivot. And they had this idea, well, maybe we'll try this social...
Did they say the word pivot when they thought that?
I wasn't there.
Okay. Because I think you could probably charge them for that.
And if only I got a royalty, that would be great.
Knowing the number of customers right now, if you could get a percentage of the times that they use the word pivot at Groupon, you could be a millionaire, Eric.
Feel free to send your nickels to it. No, just kidding. So they decided they're going to pivot. And they didn't want to spend another year and build all this technology and kind of do it the way they had been doing. So they did something really almost embarrassingly simple. They just took a simple WordPress blog and they reskinned it to say Groupon. And they did the first Groupon, which was 2-for-1 pizza in the pizza restaurant in the lobby of their building. Okay? They literally made the coupons on their laptop with PDF Maker, and they emailed each individual person who wanted the coupon. I think they sold 20 coupons the first time. Now, I know if you were there, you would have understood that 20 people getting a free pizza equals the fastest company in history to make $1 billion in revenue. I mean, it would be obvious, right? Of course.
Innovation,
what could be more obvious? I'm not so
commerce.
Smart. I would not have been able to figure it out. Obviously, our audience is a lot smarter. And that's the thing. From the outside, what's 20 pizzas? But because they had spent that year failing, they understood what it meant that they could get 20 people to do anything at all. Right? It's actually excruciatingly difficult, as several companies who've tried to copy them have found out to their chagrin. It looks easy from the outside, but it's actually quite hard. And so that is the essence of a pivot, right? Learning from what isn't working to figure out what does. And because they didn't spend a lot of time wasting time on complicated technology and algorithms, they were able to get that information immediately and then start to do more and more and more things. So I really think it's going to be known as one of the classic pivot stories, however Groupon turns out.
So they at least got people to buy some pizza, and they cared.
Yeah, I mean that, you know, like I said, it, from the outside may not seem like a big deal, but actually was a very important indicator.
So let's talk a little bit about a homegrown Silicon Valley story, and Drew Houston and Dropbox, which you know, a couple of years ago, I don't think too many people had heard of, but nowadays is actually probably valued at over $1 billion. Mm-hmm. My mom uses it to share pictures with my wife about our kids, and
it's a great product.
Actually seems to be quite a successful company, even by Silicon Valley lofty standards. Mm-hmm. So what part about Dropbox do you think is lean or was lean?
They have a great minimum viable product story, because for the engineers who are familiar with the Dropbox products about file synchronization, it's actually incredibly difficult, technically speaking, to build. You've got to integrate with all these different platforms and computers, and people are trusting you with their files, so you can't lose them. I mean, it's important. And so the founders were very technical, and they knew this was going to be a really difficult challenge. And they had this intrinsic belief that if they could just make the product work like magic, you know, it just works, and it's simple and easy to use, does one thing extremely well, customers would flock to it. When they would pitch this idea to VCs, every VC was like, oh, there's 100 products that do something similar. There's no market for this. It makes no sense. So they needed a way to figure out if there's, in fact, a market for this product without taking the 2 years it would have taken to build it. So they did something that is so simple, most entrepreneurs I know are like, that's too simple to possibly work. It's like, wait, what? Simple is good. So they built a video. The video is totally banal demo of Drew, the founder, using the product. And it just shows you, you know, him using it, showing you the files. It's a completely bogus video. They had not actually built the product to do those things yet, but they made the video look exactly how it was supposed to look. And they posted it on sites where technology early adopters hang out. And just as a little Easter egg, if you look really carefully and look at what the files are that he's moving around, every single one is a little in-joke from one of these communities. So it was kind of a nod to say, hey, we understand who you are. We think you're going to like this product. And overnight, practically, they had thousands and thousands of people sign up to get early access to Dropbox. And that is the essence of trying to figure out, hey, how are we going to find what we call early adopters for my product? Before something can be used by Dave's mom and other mainstream customers, it first has to be used by early adopters, people who don't mind signing up for a product that doesn't exist yet, because they're that excited about what it could give them. And so if you think about it, it's not a technology problem. You wouldn't think technologists would have even come up with this. I think it's actually quite remarkable that they had the courage to do that. And the best thing about minimum viable product, as opposed to a focus group or some kind of market research, is it immediately sets you up for your next set of experiments, because you don't have to ask, well, I got, who should we experiment on? Because you got the people right there. The people who signed up are the very people who you will be your early beta testers, the people who will try the product when it's ready and give you that early feedback.
So I think we were also interested in learning a little bit about how this could be applied outside just tech and software. And I think your last example, Alphabet Energy, is in a different segment. I think maybe that's not a familiar household name to people here. So can
not
you tell
yet.
Us a little
not
bit
yet.
There?
So Alphabet Energy is a company that came out of the Berkeley National Labs. They have a product called a thermoelectric material. This is literally a material that, when it gets really hot, puts out electricity. So it converts waste heat into electricity. It's a very important problem that needs to be solved for clean tech. So it's not exactly your typical software company. But they have adopted these ideas just the same. They built the material out of silicon, which means it can be manufactured in the same manufacturing facilities that build today's microprocessors. Actually, yesterday's microprocessors, because compared to a microprocessor, this is actually a very simple object. So they can go from a new idea for a version of this product to physical product in their hand in about 6 weeks, which is a dramatic change in the way physical things are being manufactured. And this changes everywhere you look in every physical industry, the same change is underway. Things like 3D printing, something called CNC, computer numerical control of manufacturing. For a wide range of objects, we can now go from, you know, computer model of that object to physical thing in days and weeks instead of months and years. And therefore, the cost structure is radically different. But also, the cycle time is radically different. And you would think for a product that makes electricity is a commodity market, you know, very simple. It'd be very easy to evaluate whether this product would work, but it turns out it's never that easy. So even though this material works, even though it's proven in the lab, you know, who should actually be the first customers? So for example, one of their initial ideas was, well, you know, you want to generate electricity, you know, you go to where the electricity is. It's like, why do you rob a bank? Because that's where the money is. Where's electricity? Oh, power plants. Power plants would be the perfect place. They have tremendous waste heat. We could reclaim some of that heat, make your power plant more efficient. What could be more obvious? Except, guess what? Power plants are regulated entities, and they are not exactly early adopters. They want to be the last people to adopt a new technology, because if it doesn't work, you know, they get in really big trouble. So imagine if they had spent years building out the infrastructure to serve these very demanding customers, and then, oops, they're not willing to adopt no matter what. because they were able to find out that they were on the wrong track much sooner, they were able to pivot to different businesses. And today they have discovered a bunch of different classes of situations where there's waste heat that needs to be converted into electricity, where that's a benefit. But they're not so risky that if the technology doesn't work, somebody goes to jail. That's your classic early adopter. So it's the exact same pattern of figuring out how to test in microscale, build that minimum viable product, and then rapidly evolve and iterate. It's not software anymore. It's now physical goods.
So once again, we're listening to Eric Ries, author of The Lean Startup. The program here tonight is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, the place to connect your intellect. And I'm Dave McClure at 500 Startups. Let's talk a little bit about the future, and then we'll have our audience ask a few questions. And remember, intelligent, short, poignant questions by our audience. So if Lean Startup is a methodology that can be applied not just to technology, not just to startups, you know, where can we take that? How can we be improving sort of our everyday lives? And, you know, are there places where we can take that outside the U.S., into government, maybe into, you know, child care? What's the Lean Startup for moms look like, Eric? Any thoughts or ideas there?
Well, wherever there is uncertainty, there is entrepreneurship. So I'm not going to answer your child care question because I'm not even remotely qualified. But what I will say is that these ideas are being practiced in places I never would have imagined when I first started writing about this. The very first time I gave a talk about Lean Startup, I was extremely nervous. I didn't know what was going to be like. I mean, I'm an engineer by training, so I did not imagine one day I would be a professional expert, whatever that is. No idea. So I was really nervous, and I really wanted to put the practice of entrepreneurship on a rigorous footing, so that required starting with a definition. And so I got up in front of a lot of people, and I said, listen, a startup is a human institution designed to create something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty. That's fundamentally what it is. And from that, I derive the things we've been talking about, that entrepreneurship is a management discipline that deals with uncertainty, et cetera. And I put a asterisk. I said, you know, what's funny about that definition is it doesn't say anything about size of company, doesn't say anything about what sector of the economy you work in or even what industry you work in. And therefore, these ideas should be just as relevant to people in big companies, in Fortune 500 companies, in nonprofits, in government. I had no idea if that was true at the time that I said it. I mean, I said it as confidently as I could muster, but I really didn't know. My background is in small, you know, high-tech companies. That's what I know. But it seemed logically true that should happen, and I was like, well, I wonder what will happen. And from that very first day, people started to come up to me who you would not peg as entrepreneurs by the conventional definition. They don't wear a hoodie. They don't eat ramen noodles. They go into an office. But they have the exact same problems as entrepreneurs do. And they have been guided by a set of management practices that says, you know, if you want to incubate an entrepreneurial, you know, team inside a big company, make sure you give it a separate P&L and make sure they, you know, have a, you know, independent development authority and make sure they report to the right kind and get the right kind of people. And there's all these checklists, what I call the entrepreneurial prerequisites. But when they would talk to me, they would say, you know, it's kind of like I got the wood and the kindling and some paper, but where's my fire? What should the people inside this innovation black box actually do every day? Because the conventional management wisdom on this topic is basically silent. It just says, make sure you set it up and everything will work out just fine. But those of us who have been in that situation know it's actually extremely difficult and confusing. And so I have had the chance to work with a lot of entrepreneurs and managers putting these ideas into practice in really strange places. I was actually just at the White House. And I say that not just to show off, although it was pretty cool. The Obama administration has...
What color is the White House, Eric? How are we sure that you were there?
I have pictures. I have pictures that I was not supposed to take. I was very excited. The Obama administration is actually really interested in the question of how do we make governance more effective. And so they are working on stuff that, you know, if you watch cable news, you would have no idea this is going on. But President Obama is the first president to appoint a nation's chief technology officer and a nation's chief information officer. And they are tasked with trying to figure out how do we make government more efficient by taking ideas from the private sector. And they are in the middle of some really amazing projects that are using the Lean Startup methodology to say, instead of the typical government thing, which is make a giant plan and a huge bureaucracy take years, they have had a series of projects where they have said, we're going to take 90 days from concept to minimum viable product. We're going to get feedback from citizens to figure out, is this in fact helping, and then iterate from there. And so by injecting these ideas into government, we're actually uncovering all kinds of new and exciting ideas that I think are in fact pro-growth. Because by liberating the data, by creating these platforms for experimentation, you invite the private sector, you actually invite startups to engage with you also, because now you're operating at a speed that startups can understand. And, you know, this is early days, this is just at the beginning, but I think is really a very exciting thing. So the movement has grown way beyond the roots of places like Silicon Valley. It really is now a worldwide movement for change. And what we want to do, what we believe at our heart, is that most of the innovation work we do today is a waste of time. We have people working really, really hard on things that don't matter, and in their hearts, they know it. They know when they go into work every day that nobody cares about what they're doing but their boss. And that is a horrible, soul-destroying feeling for those who've ever had the experience. And so we believe as an industrial civilization, we are wasting people's time at scale. And we actually can do something about it. So that's our mission.
So I'm going to start with our first question here. But if we could ask folks who would like to ask a question to line up at the mics, I'll try it again. Make sure that you ask those short, poignant, very relevant questions without long introductions, unlike the one I'm asking right now. So, Eric, if we apply Lean Startup to an industry that's near and dear to my heart, the venture capital industry, would you say that the trend is in a positive direction? I guess to maybe paraphrase a show that you and I are both fans of, is winter coming for the venture capital industry, and anything we can learn about lean startups applied to investing?
Yeah, winter is coming. We're in the summer years of entrepreneurship right now. Everything's easy and money is flowing and entrepreneurship is sexy and cool. And like I said, entrepreneurship needs to get a lot more boring because the reality is it's excruciating, not cool. What will happen when winter comes...
Wait, what? Entrepreneurship isn't cool.
No, it's not. Trust me, I've been there. Sorry. And people who get into it, just like in the last bubble, people who got into it for the cool are going to get out of it real fast when winter comes.
Exactly.
Here's the problem with summer. It is impossible to tell which of the current crop of incubators, accelerators, investors, M&A people, CFOs, who's actually creating value and who's just riding the summer trend up. Because when everything's going well, everybody seems like they're making money. Everyone seems like they're making progress. But we know that most of it is success theater, not real progress. So when winter comes, we're going to find out who's really creating value and who isn't. I think that's great news because every dollar we can take away from the success theater is a dollar we can invest in actual creation of progress. So the question I have been asking everybody in the startup ecosystem, entrepreneurs, investors, lawyers, PR people, everybody in the ecosystem, think really hard about the organizations that you engage with. Which of them are actually creating value and who's just manufacturing hype? Because the hype is fun, we're all having a good time, but when winter comes, what's going to be important for sustaining and nurturing entrepreneurs is that we're developing new and successful ideas about how to make entrepreneurs succeed. And so that's the question that we all need to be asking ourselves. And I think if we take a hard look in the mirror, we will realize that a lot of what we're doing now, it's fun, it's cool, it gets us in the press, it's all good. Except it's not actually creating any value, and therefore it's no better than a Ponzi scheme. No better. We owe it to the next generation of entrepreneurs to do better than that.
So again, we're here at the Commonwealth Club's InForum, the place to connect your intellect, and tonight we're hosting Eric Ries, author of The Lean Startup. Can we take the first question, please?
Yeah, my name is Alex, and so I understand that there's a lot of people that aren't necessarily in entrepreneurial roles that can still benefit from the lean startup methodology. I was wondering if you think that there's ever a point of oversaturation or there's too many entrepreneurs. Do you think there's ever a point of...
Yeah, thank you for that.
So how many entrepreneurs do we have, Eric, and are there too many yet?
Well, you can never have too many entrepreneurs. From the economy's point of view, entrepreneurship is the source of net new job growth. If you look at the academic research, it's very clear that net new job growth the last two decades has all come from high-growth startups, not at all from the Fortune 500 or the big companies. So as an economy, we want to have as many entrepreneurs as possible. Now, the more entrepreneurs we have, the more failed entrepreneurs we're going to have, and that can be very painful. And from a public policy point of view, if we want to promote job growth, what we need to do is create policies that make it possible for people to fail and not, for example, put their children's health at risk. So, you know, for all the, you know, ridiculous propaganda going on right now about job creators this and taxes that, the truth is rich people are not job creators. Entrepreneurs are job creators. And so the policies that nurture entrepreneurs are the policies that can make this new wave, this entrepreneurial renaissance, actually matter. When winter comes, we are going to be held to account to find out, well, how many actual entrepreneurs did we fund? How many actual successful, sustainable businesses did we build? And, you know, that is why I spend my time doing this. I really believe if we can change the process we use to build companies, we can change those outcomes. And I think that's a very important thing. You know, that is the future of our economy. So it's time to get serious about it.
Next question, please.
Hey, Eric. My name is Michael. I've been a big fan for a while. I've been reading your blog for a few years, so it's great to see you in person.
Thank you so much.
My question for you is this. I work at a tech company, 40 to 50 people. Haven't achieved product market fit yet, but people are working hard, coming to the office every day. We're building a lot of stuff. But, you know, things aren't clicking together as fast as we want. So my question is, what's the best way to introduce the ideas in the lean startup to the management and get support and to start getting the company right on track faster?
Yeah. Without getting fired.
That's right.
Thank you for that indelicate but very important qualifier. What did I tell you before? When an entrepreneur has gotten funded, they're working. We know for sure that the money got spent. We know for sure everyone was busy. We know for sure the product milestones are being hit.
40 or 50 people. I think there's quite a lot of money being spent.
These are expensive failures when we get them wrong. And the biggest risk for startups is not that they fail outright. I've had some pretty spectacular failures in my career. And although they're very painful, it's actually a blessing. If it just the whole thing explodes, you get no traction, it's a disaster. At least it's over quickly. But a lot of companies can limp along indefinitely in the land of the living dead. And so how do you know if your company, I mean, I understand not your company, but your friend's company, how do you know if they're on the brink of product market fit or not? What can you do? And so then here's the thing. There are so many startup experts. Now, the thing about summer is we have this phenomenon we call summer's children. You know, the people who come out of the woodwork in summer to sell things to entrepreneurs. And look who's talking. Okay, so Peter Drucker once said famously that people called him a guru because they couldn't spell charlatan. I was like, so true. So when an entrepreneur gets up on stage and tells you, I did X and then I got really rich, and so if you do X, you'll get really rich too, what are you supposed to do with that information? It's like five different logical fallacies in one, right? How do you know they really did X? How do you know that X caused them to get rich? How do you know they got rich because of rather than in spite of X? How do you know that what worked in the past will work in the present? How do you know what worked in their industry will work in yours? Answer, I don't know. So how do we get out of that problem? And the answer is we have to create theories of entrepreneurship that are themselves scientific and that therefore make testable predictions. Here's the nice thing about the truth. Every part of the truth is similar to every other part. So if you just try a little bit, you should be able to evaluate, hey, does this actually make sense? And then if it does work, if it does as predicted, then you can do a little bit more. And that is the key to any lean transformation, is to find a point of intervention where you can make a significant difference to how the company's doing, incubate the change small, and then use that early success as a way of expanding. But Dave's caveat about getting fired is so important because this goes directly against the dominant paradigm we have all been trained at as functional specialists and managers. So one of the places to start is to start with this idea of minimum viable product. Work backwards from what do we need to learn to what do we need to do instead of just making as much stuff as possible. As soon as you make that change, even in the tiniest project, I predict the following. Here's what the scientific theory predicts. Here's what will happen. I've seen this happen in so many companies. Halfway through whatever that initiative is, people will start to respectfully request that you go back to the old way because they no longer feel productive. Here's the thing. In startups, stuff's going wrong all the time. So how do you know if the stuff that is going wrong is related to the change you're making or isn't? The temptation is always going to be, well, we made this change, things are going wrong, therefore this change caused them to go wrong, let's go back. Well, we are actually trying to make people unproductive. Unproductive in the sense they're used to measuring their productivity by how much stuff did I make today? And now we're asking them to measure, well, how much did you learn today? And sometimes learning requires doing activities that have nothing to do with making stuff, like GASP, talking to customers, running experiments, looking at data. And it makes engineers act like marketers, and marketers act like engineers, and it completely demolishes all these functional departmental silos we've all been working in. And that can be really uncomfortable. So I predict if you make this change and you see that discomfort, that means it's working. See, that's what I mean by a testable prediction. So if you follow the rest of the model, you can be ready to anticipate those problems and prepare people for them, you know, before it's too late. But I'll give you another handy tip. This is just from my point of view. I'm actually indifferent as to whether your company succeeds or fails, because I know in your next company you're not going to make these mistakes again. And so from a long-term trajectory, you know, I'm content to wait. And you can try that line on your co-founders too and see. You know, it's you think the current model works fine, you know, good luck.
So I think that what you just said was, I don't really care whether this baby lives or dies, but the next one will survive. That's sort of the storyline.
It's not my baby.
That's sort of not going to be. That's going to be tough for a lot of like entrepreneurs to swallow that understanding, I guess.
Listen, it is. It's better to find out that your brilliant idea is terrible, now, right? Before you went and told everybody in the world how great it was, before you made the embarrassment even worse. So, you know, we say fail faster because not that we want the company to fail, we want the bad ideas to fail because we can get through those bad ideas, we can get to the good ones.
All right, next question.
How do you determine the right balance between promoting your minimum viable product enough to get enough users to tell you what's good and what sucks and not becoming an overhyped company? How do you find that balance?
That's a great question.
That's a great question. It's actually really easy because you just don't want to do any hype at all. Yeah. And I know it just sounds crazy, but when I tell people that learning is the unit of progress in entrepreneurship, that sounds pretty good. Who's not for learning, right? Learning, yeah, sure, of course I'm for learning. But it has consequences that I kind of sneak in there. It's like a Trojan horse for like, wait a minute. If learning is a unit of progress, then getting bigger is not an indicator of progress. Having more customers is not our goal. Making more money is not our goal.
What?
And then at this point, entrepreneurs are like, wait, what train did I board? I did not sign up for that. I thought learning, that seemed innocuous. No, it's painful. But here's the thing. I've had plenty of entrepreneurs be like, we can't test our idea because, you know, if we show it to three or four people, that's not a statistically significant sample. And I once had the experience of, you know, I told you at InView, we built that initial product that was totally wrong. And I remember the first time we did a usability test. We were like desperate. Why won't people use this product? Well, let's see what happens if we bring a customer in here. First time, customer came in and we said, all right, we want you to try this thing. It was an instant messaging add-on. It interoperates. It has a great strategy. Customer was like, no thanks. I'd rather not. We're like, no. We're paying you to be here, so you're going to do it. And they're like, no, this is too weird for me. And I was like, fire that customer. Get me a new one, right? I just can't believe it. Well, then the second customer comes in and says the exact same thing. And I was like, and now I'm turning to the person who helped me set up the usability test. I'm like, what is wrong with you? Keep finding these weirdo customers who don't want to use my product. Okay, well, now when three customers in a row did it, is that a statistically significant sample? How about if five people in a row did it? How about 10 out of 10 not only won't even try my product? Do I need to go put out a press release and get a million more customers? What is the learning value of the 11th customer, the 100th customer, the 1,000th customer? Zero. No learning value at all. Because look, our notions of statistical significance come from things like presidential elections, where we're trying to measure the difference between a tenth of a point here and a tenth of a point there, because elections can be won 50.1% to 49.9. But we forget that one of the factors in the equation for statistical significance is what's the signal-to-noise ratio of the thing you're trying to measure. And if people hate your product, the signal is really clear. All you have to do is be willing to listen to it. So that's actually the technical answer to your question is you always want to work backwards from how much data do I need to know if I'm on the right track. But the good thing is you can always get more data. So why not start with less and just see what happens? Because like I said, I'm sure your idea is excellent. But maybe you have a friend. And your friend's idea could use for maybe just 10 people checking it out and just confirming. Just double check that the idea is really as brilliant as you think.
I think I have some personal experience with a lot of that type of testing. But one thing I love about what you just said is a lot of times the feedback loop that's helpful is hate. And I often say, like, hate is actually a pretty good signal. You can actually pivot around hate. What you can't pivot around is indifference or non-use.
Yeah, indifference is the worst. One of the practices we used to do at InView was every time an engineer would change the product, they would go into our public forums and they would post under their own name, "Hi, I'm Eric. I just made this amazing, great change. You're going to love it." And that was an open thread for comment. Now, sometimes customers would be like, "You're a genius. That's awesome." Sometimes customers would be like, "You idiot. I can't believe you wasted your time." Either way, and that's, you know, difficult for engineers, but they're getting the feedback directly. That is not at all the most difficult result. The most difficult result is I post this thing, a great new feature, and no comments. These are crazy early adopter, you know, internet forums people, and none of them has any opinion about this thing whatsoever. How great a feature can it be? And here's the thing. Most engineers are trained that when that happens, it's some product manager's fault. Not my fault. I just executed the spec as I was told. But we want them to get that feedback directly so that they can have that feeling in the pit of the stomach that says, no, if you're doing the wrong thing, it's your responsibility to learn from that and prevent it from happening. So we used to say at InView, doing what you're told is a fireable offense.
I think we have time for a few more questions. Can we take one more?
Yeah. Thanks for breaking that down, Eric.
Thank you.
I have a quick question about patents.
Are you sure it's a quick question?
Yeah, it's pretty quick. It'll be quick. You mentioned Dropbox a second ago and about how Drew put up that video of him using the product and how there was a whole bunch of ones similar to it before and now there's a whole bunch of similar ones now. And would it have been a better idea in general for people to take out patents before they put up a video like that? And is there any reason not to?
take too long? Like, I'm just curious on how important that is in general.
This is the stealth question also, isn't it?
Yeah. I am not a lawyer. And if you want, before you do anything relating to patents, you must consult an attorney because the issues are actually unbearably complicated. And it's actually one of the problems with our patent system that inhibits innovation is that it's so complicated and expensive, you have to talk to an expensive lawyer just to find out what you should do with the patent system or not. And so patent reform is an urgent, urgent public policy problem that the current patent reform bill, you know, was a huge missed opportunity to actually make this better for entrepreneurs, a huge disappointment. Software and business model patents are basically a bane of our society, and so they have to be eliminated or significantly reformed. But as an entrepreneur, you got to deal with the patent system that we actually have, not the one that we ought to have. And in some jurisdictions, releasing a product starts the clock for when you can apply for patent protection, which is just the worst possible choice you can make from a public policy point of view. And so you have to talk to a lawyer to understand in the jurisdictions you care about, what do you do, how do you get feedback on your product without starting that clock, or just early file all your patents. The dirty little secret is that all of us who have software patents, especially who've had them in startups, I got a bunch of software patents, we're embarrassed. The patents are horrible. They have almost no value. They represent no innovation. They're something we do. They're basically an innovation tax. It's absurd. So you still have to do it. You know, you still have to get the patents. It's like having a nuclear deterrent. You have to have it even if you never want to use it. Except from an actual practice standpoint, the only time patents matter is if you're on the brink of a true scientific breakthrough. If one of you is working on a business that's going to invent teleportation, first of all, go work on that. I want to have that product. So ASAP.
I just funded three teleportation startups last week, Eric.
Awesome. Great. I will be an early adopter. Well, I don't know if I want to be an early adopter. But once you work out the bugs, I will totally be a customer. Here's the problem. Most startups think their product is teleportation, when in fact it's not nearly as good. So yes, there are these limited cases where patents are extremely important. Please consult with a lawyer who knows what they're talking about, who's worked with startups before you decide if you're in that case or not.
So I apologize to the gentleman with the awesome questions about to come up, but we're going to wrap up here. I know those were short and poignant questions, so I really apologize.
Thank you.
But Eric, before we finish, again, I'd like to thank you for actually bringing the Lean Startup book to press.
And thank you.
Again, for those who haven't heard of it before, it's already number 2 on the bestseller list for the New York Times, but we'd really like to help Eric be more of a success story, so please go out and buy it as soon as this program ends, or if you're listening online. So Eric, last question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? And, you know, is that something you're already practicing in the Lean Startup, or do you have a little more secret sauce ready for us?
In the very last chapter of the book, I mention an idea that is probably too crazy to happen, but I'm not sure. It's called the long-term stock exchange. Here's in brief. We right now in innovation hubs like Silicon Valley have become a feeder system for giant investment banks and media companies. I don't understand why we're proud of that. We know when we sell companies or we make them go public, the short-term pressures of our current public markets start the inexorable decline. I don't think it has to be that way. So we don't need to feed the beast. Why are we sending our companies to Wall Street to be destroyed? Why don't we create an alternate place for them to go public? I call it the long-term stock exchange, only to trade in the stocks of companies that are designed for long-term thinking. We would have much higher transaction fees to prevent quantitative trading and day trading. We would have management structures that are designed to give management complete autonomy to invest in the long term, increased transparency requirements in exchange to really make them demonstrate using innovation accounting what are they doing to invest in the future, and therefore have a place that actually nurtures long-term thinking, investments in innovation, and building sustainable businesses. Because the current system destroys companies, it needs a steady supply of new companies to survive. We're feeding it right now. We're making the current system possible, so why don't we cut off the supply and send them someone better? Anyway, probably too crazy to happen, but that's what I believe.
Well, I'd like to thank Eric for sharing his thoughts about the Lean Startup movement with us tonight. Let's give him a big round of applause.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of InForum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.